Hey, it's Karen Hunter from the Karen Hunter Show on SiriusXM Urban View. Here's a highlight from today's show. Let me welcome to the show. He is a historian of the British Empire. He is also the author of The Great Defiance, How the World Took on the British Empire. Let me welcome for the first time, Dr. David Vevers. Hi.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi. So it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for staying up across the pond. It's, what is it, like 9:30 at night there?
It's almost 9:30. I've watched Succession. I'm ready for this.
Okay, wait a minute. So that made it across because two of the actors are from Great Britain, right? So Shiv Tom are both Brits.
That's right. And we see them from very kind of local shows, and then it's suddenly like that's really jarring that they're on this big US, you know, star-studded show. It's just so weird when we see that kind of thing happen.
And to be clear, Australia is part of the British Empire, is it?
It's now obviously still the head of state. Obviously, is the British Crown as well. So it's slightly complicated, unraveling relationship. But it is indeed. Yeah, that's right.
I feel like everyone's unraveling its relationship with Great Britain. I was saying on the show last week that if the Queen had passed 20 years earlier, she would have gotten such a better, there wouldn't have been protests and things. Had that happened, Charles would have been, you know, even though you guys had off the day of school and things, it was like the rest of the world was like, who cares? Look at his hands. Yeah. He's trash. Yeah, yeah. Camilla's trash. The monarchy's trash. They should go away. You know, you got Jamaica giving them the middle finger. You got Ireland. You got the Wales giving them their booty to look at. You know, it's the Scottish. You're like, ah, middle fingers to you. We hate you.
That was good. That was like that was a wake up call. We've always seen ourselves with the rest of the world almost through monarchy, like this glorious kind of image that we've got. And I think that her passing was a kind of wake up call that actually, no, people around the world don't share that kind of whitewashed view of the monarchy. And we've got all the trappings over here and all the traditions and the glamour, but actually for large parts of the world, 400 million of whom were once under British rule and suffered. Yeah, it was like a lot of people actually don't like Britain and they actually have a serious reckoning with Britain's past in a way that we haven't really had here. Mm. So I think that actually started a really important conversation. But it was like you jump on Twitter the next day and it's, everyone hates Britain. Where did that come from? But actually that's been, you know, that's been bubbling for decades. Yep. Absolutely.
Dr. Vevers, even as you're talking, I'm thinking about, like, America is so immature as a nation. It's a very young nation and it is really struggling with its history, and its history is so much shorter than Great Britain. So y'all got like maybe close to 700 years of colonization and horrors that, you know, partition and slavery, and like you got 700 years to reckon with. America's got like a couple of hundred, you know, and it still is struggling through. As a person, and I call people without a lot of melanin melanemic, as a melanemic person growing up in Great Britain, is it hard for you to reckon with the things that you now know about the nation? Because I'm sure just like here, you were taught all of the great things and that you discovered everything.
Absolutely. And that's the kind of, like in the States, that's a massive kind of embittered, very contested conversation that's going on. But I mean, yeah, for me, for kind of, you know, a white guy from the south of England, very prosperous area, grew up in school, you know, we didn't actually get taught a lot about our sort of colonial past. And if we did, it was like, you know, well, Britain abolished the slave trade. But it's like, well, yeah, but also we spent 250 years as the leading slave trader in the whole world, and so we got those sort of cherry-picked lessons in history that you come out thinking, you know, it's like, oh, famine, yes, that was bad, but yeah, we gave the world cricket and the English language and you know, and British education. Doesn't matter that we took those things that already existed and we you know, westernized them. So yeah, so it's, you know, for me in my journey as a historian, you know, a lot of people I speak to, is that gradually, you know, the kind of history we taught was just so carefully selected and shaped, and so you've got a whole, you know, multiple generations that are growing up in the post kind of imperial world where Britain is now like a, you know, like a third rate power that has very little influence, especially, you know, recently with Brexit and such, that that we have to reckon with that. And we have to kind of, you know, if we want these serious relationships with other countries, part of that is that we have to have a reckoning with, you know, the legacies of empire, of which in many ways the States is one, right? You know, you said the States is a young country. Yeah, I guess constitutionally, but you know, this, you know, the United States is also a legacy of the British Empire and the systems of slavery and you know, its economic and social structures, and so that I think is almost, you know, that's spilt over, and we've left that as a legacy for people in America to grapple with. But yeah, you know, as the, you know, as the kind of monster that created these really oppressive, you know, hierarchies racially, economically, socially, I think that we've got a lot to answer for, and we've got a lot of reckoning to do, and I think we're only scratching the surface here. And you know, it's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is because you go in the bookshops today and all the histories of these still the kind of same histories we've had here for 30, 40 years, this triumphant narrative of what Britain gave to the world and how it, you know, books like How Britain Made the Modern World, and it's very positive. We gave them democracy and the rule of law, and very little about what we took away from those people, and the impact that we had and the violence as well. So yes, you can celebrate the abolition of slavery by the British Empire, but you have to recognize that it also trafficked 3.5 million people from West Africa, many of whom died. And that's a conversation that we're really, like in the States, struggling with. Absolutely.
I don't want to even stay there, because I'm like, it is what it is, right? So we're here now. My job on these airwaves is to figure out how people could have freedom, individual freedom, community freedom, and not be oppressed ever again. So in order to do that, I think sometimes we have to deconstruct what happened, right? So the book, The Great Defiance, How the World Took on the British Empire. I'm fascinated that this little tiny island was able to take over the continent of Africa, India. It's like, what the hell? How? You talk Hong Kong, Palestine, I mean, all the way Uganda. You know, you think about like the vast spread of, and then not even these little 13 colonies that then, you know, had a little revolt, and then kept the same practices, and then like changed around and put an S instead of a C in defense, you know, changed around a few things in language, you know, to be cute. But like, how did it happen?
I mean, that's been the remarkable story. And I think that's why it has attracted so many people to kind of the history of the British Empire. I mean, the most important question is, I mean, we often focus on the kind of later period, the modern, like the Victorian 19th century, where Britain became, you know, little old Britain, like you said, you know, perched on the northwest, you know, a region of Europe, a bit drab, a bit grey. And then suddenly, within 100 years, a quarter of the world was under British rule. I mean, it's an amazing story, and that's what first attracted me to it. I just thought, wow, what an incredible tale. And so we, you know, traditionally we've looked at things like, you know, the Industrial Revolution, in which Britain was one of the first countries to shift from, you know, mainly agriculture to building things and innovating and embracing technological change that allowed it to build kind of railways and, you know, machine guns and steamships that could traverse the world unlike ever before. And, you know, for a long time then we also thought along came that with was a superior culture, a better understanding of medicine, of science, and that we could then apply that to sort of, you know, civilize, as the language once upon a time was called, and to kind of prepare the rest of the world for that level of civilization. So it's the kind of traditional understanding has been this kind of very exceptional narrative of, you know, of British superiority. And, you know, some of, you know, sort of developments in Britain in the 19th century are pretty amazing, like the Industrial Revolution, and some of the scientific and innovative, and even the kind of cultural, if you think about the literature of the 19th century, Dickens, Hardy, and the Bronte sisters. But, you know, that's a very, I think, a very kind of now slightly outdated understanding. What I try and do with the book is show, actually, Britain was trying for about 300 years to conquer the areas that eventually did, and it wasn't easy, and they weren't overwhelmingly successful. And actually, if you take a map of the British Empire by the 20th century, it doesn't necessarily tell us all about their successes. There are big gaping blank areas which Britain never was able to conquer, not through lack of trying, but because they were resisted and they were pushed away.
Dr. Viviers? What was the first failure? Where did they first try to conquer and weren't able to?
Well, arguably you could say Ireland, because although they did eventually conquer Ireland, it was after about Ireland, which eventually ends up as a British colony, but it took about 600 or 700 years to do so. But Yeah, absolutely. So they start in like the Norman period, you know, when the guys from Normandy come over and 1066, the Battle of Hastings, all of that sort of stuff. And they kind of lash a Gaelic island with Anglo-Norman colonists, and the Irish resist. And 500 years, they basically drive the English away, and the English come back and they try again. And through famine and violence, they eventually wear the Irish down. But, you know, the Irish were never fully conquered, and they resist and they uprose, and then gradually, obviously, won. Most of Ireland wins its independence back. So that's a kind of good example of even in success, it wasn't straightforward. But a good example of where they tried but completely failed, lots of places. So Japan is a good example. Japan is this, in many ways, this great success story of avoiding European colonization. One of the few countries in Asia that ever did that. But at the beginning of the 17th century, so the early 1600s, England and other European powers take a real crack at Japan and try and kind of take control of its trade, try and expand Christianity. So it's not through lack of trade.
So I'm just, you know what's baffling to me?
Yeah.
Why? You know, these people minding their business with their Ginsu knives and, you know, doing all of this, shogun, whatever, ninjas, doing what they do. You know, I don't know what they do, right? Yeah. Speaking their language, doing their thing, living their lives. Why did Great Britain want to force Christianity, of all things, you know, and force them into this car crash? What was the goal? So you control their trade, and then what? You control and dominate them, and then what?
Yeah, and then you profit and you exploit from that, and you outcompete your rivals, especially your European rivals. But you know what drives them to do it in the first place? I think this is kind of something that's misunderstood. It's not that, you know, England or France or the Netherlands were better and more powerful. It comes from a place of weakness. They look around the rest of the world when they begin this, you know, in the 1500s, 1600s, and actually Europe is a pretty poor place. The center of the world is Asia. It's Africa.
Yes,
that's where the world economy, you know, if you open your cupboard, right, everyone's got a cupboard of spices, you know, pepper and cardamom. If you open that little cupboard of yours 500 years ago, that little cupboard would have been worth its weight in gold. Things like spices drove the world economy. Europe doesn't have spices. It doesn't have gold. It doesn't have silk, all porcelain, all the goods and everything the rest of the world. So why not just
move to these places? Because it was like, if you think about Africa or even India or even China, you're right. It was a spice. Yeah. It was a spice trade, right? So everyone was trading, right? You got the Africans are trading with the Asians. Everybody for thousands of years, people were just trading. You have something, I have something. So what you're saying is they had nothing to trade, so they just came in and took.
Yeah, so a really good example. I love this one. When the English first go over to India, they turn up, England's biggest export was woolen goods, right? So they turn up with a bunch of woolly jumpers in India where it's 40 degrees. And no one wants woolly jumpers, not even at Christmas. And, you know, they're draped in Chinese silk and sumptuous Indian cotton tech. And the English cannot sell any of their merchandise. And so, yeah, part of it's from a sense of, you know, no one wants what the English are selling. The English, you know, have very little wealth or power. And so from that kind of frustration, they turn to, you know, cultural bigotry and discrimination. They start to kind of cast these people, they kind of other them as being lesser than them and justify their use of violence to try and get.
Wait, can you just pause for a second, Dr. David Verveers, because the gaslighting right now is stunning. So you come to a place, it's 80, 90 degrees with wool.
Yeah.
First of all, I'm questioning your intellect. It's hot. Okay. Let's bring wool to a hot place. Okay. That's it. You find out nobody wants what you're selling. You go back home and you devise a plan to tell the world that these people are inferior and they're stupid. Yeah. And then you have guns. So now you can enforce the gaslighting. That's the history. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's a kind of, you know, it's not exceptional to Europe at the time. You know, like the Chinese were kind of, you know, using stereotypes against the Japanese and so forth. But it's the Europeans that tend to then apply violence to that equation and justify that use of violence. And so they go in from a place of kind of frustration and weakness. And instead of peacefully trading, and they, you know, they do that as well, but mostly it ends in violence and they kind of tend to coerce these people to give them spices or silk or Indian cotton textiles, those kind of things that drove the economy. So yeah, and some of this cultural prejudice is, you know, stunning in the fact that it's gaslighting, it's completely bonkers, none of it makes sense. But then you can sort of see them when you go in the archives and read the documents, they're sort of trying desperately to convince themselves. And it's kind of pathetic. But you know, it when they worked, turn
though,
up.
But I mean, so this is the thing to me that I'm constantly like, okay, mediocre, not too bright, but they were they were willing to kill. So brutal. Yeah. Which, you know, takes people by, you know, surprise, because you're like, well, you're going to kill me? Over? Okay, I didn't see this coming. What? Yeah. We actually are in chains now? Wait, you put me in a boat? I got to go. What is happening? Who does this, right? And then you devise this system. So I need to know, who is the person, Dr. Verveers? Who's the architect of this gaslighting venture that absolutely worked? So they're brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no individual. I mean, you could sort of shed light on the English crown, for example. You know, the crown is, we kind of removed the monarchy from our imperial history, but actually back then it was really quite tightly integrated. The crown launches the Royal African Company, which becomes the largest trafficker in people from West Africa. And that's a charter that they launched. They're invested in the company. The Duke of York, who becomes King James II of England, has his initials branded on enslaved people. And so the crown is kind of completely bound up with these colonial enterprises. And there's a lot of, you know, really interesting research actually just being done by historians from the States and from the UK on that, which I think is interesting. So usually the kind of crown's been very sanitized and kind of withdrawn. But then, you know, even if you think about Queen Elizabeth II, who had a honeymoon to Prince Philip in Kenya, which was a scene of the Mau Mau uprising and the brutal suppression of the Kenyan people for independence. You know, this is a long, bloody history for the crown and colonialism. But so you can look at the crown and their relationship to that. But there's also a whole industry, a whole kind of economy geared towards stereotyping these people and making these cases back home for why we should go over there and invade there. Or to occupy there. And, you know, it's, yeah, nationwide. It's not, you know, it's not a few rotten apples. This is a kind of societal, system. A kind of cultural system.
Yeah. Dr. David Verveers is here. He's the author of The Great Defiance, How the World Took on the British Empire. I learned about the Kenyan part watching The Crown. And I was sitting there, I was waiting. I was like, as I see the little black kids run to give the queen all of the things. And I'm like, oh, look. And then I'm like, wait a minute. Hold up. And she's, oh, hell no. I was like, I'm sitting there angry. I couldn't keep watching it because I was like, this is some bull crap, because you're romanticizing literal and going to Africa and seeing all these little kids dressed in the little uniform, speaking English, praying to white Jesus. I'm like, this was effective. Damn it, I'm speaking English. I'm speaking another language. How did this happen?
It is effective. And that's the thing. It's you know, we may recoil from it, but it was highly effective. And, you know, you see echoes in that today with who are now obviously the Prince and Princess of Wales, William and Kate, that, you know, recently, last year, they had the tour of the Caribbean, and they're dressed like William's grandparents were 50 years ago when they did those colonial tours, you know, standing up, dressing all this regalia and waving to, you know, the locals. And it's just, you know, it's these kind of rank kind of colonial tropes that we're still regurgitating. And it's widely, you know, publicized in the press. And isn't this wonderful? You think, hold on, this is, you know, these are, you know, foreign people, you know, these are coming over, these are mostly descendants of enslaved people that were trafficked and funded by these people's ancestors. It's just kind of such a gross relationship. And I think that one of the things, you know, we were speaking about earlier about, you know, with the death of Queen Elizabeth II, is that people are starting, I think, to kind of reevaluate that a bit more. And so you know, these cultural prejudices we're kind of recoiling at, these haven't gone away. They're still kind of ingrained in kind of Britain's relationship with the rest of the world. And I think that that's a good thing that's happening now. We're starting to reassess that. And I think that, you know, you could see, you know, I was thinking, you know, who are these people's publicists? You know, he's got a kind of pith helmet on and, you know, all these medals, and he's waving to, you know, all these Afro-Caribbean children. And it's just, you know, yeah, the optics were just horrendous.
Well, I mean, when would they, who's going to tell them? You know, so because they think Harry and Meghan are drama queens who want attention, right? So that's the narrative. So they, you know, so they're over there. We don't have a race problem. Look, I have a gospel choir. Look, there are black people. There's a black person with a wig on. Look, we're not racist. We got, you know, what? I let your mother come. You know, like, so who's going to tell them that the world has moved on and you are still stuck in the 1800s that doesn't exist anymore? No one's here for it.
Yeah, and the problem with the way that's consumed here in the UK is it's an echo chamber. It, because the institution of the crown has become so sacred, no one sort of dares really, you know, criticize. There's very few, you know, the media, for example, it's very much a kind of client media. It's there to reinforce, you know, the crown and its interests and to celebrate it. And, you know, when we had the coronation of Charles recently, there were some protesters that had t-shirts, you know, not my king, and they were kind of brutally cracked down on, arrested without having actually committed a crime. And you just think that this is the kind of a 21st century society that sort of projects itself as very modern and liberal, and you can't even question the crown and you know, its popularity in the 21st century. And so for me, so there's no chance really, except through things like academic scholarship and, you know, and being educated, that it's just such an echo chamber here. And I think we need the rest of the world to sort of grab us and shake us and say, you know, for God's sake, you know, what are you doing? This is weird. So I sort of appreciate getting anyone's input that doesn't come from the UK. It's, you know, it's refreshing to hear.
Dr. David Verveers is here. He got his PhD from the University of Kent, specializing in the British Empire. He also has a book called The Origins of the British Empire in Asia, which was published by Cambridge University Press a couple of years ago. The latest book is The Great Defiance, How the World Took on the British Empire. So what world? Who took them on? What happened? What should we know about this? And then how does it inform our future? Dr. Verveers.
Yeah, and thanks for the question. I think it's really important for the future, especially because, you know, one of the things, if you go in the bookshops, there's just all these shelves covered with the wonderful history of the British Empire. And what happens is some of the most important scholarship we've done in the past sort of 30, 40 years is to look at the way in which colonial violence perpetuated exploitation and oppression, Britain's role in the slave trade. But in some ways, what we've done is we've reduced all non-European people to victims. And while the victimhood is a really important element of the story, occasionally we kind of cast the Europeans as superior, as, you know, as kind of conquering everyone else. And so what this book is trying to do is that actually, yes, indigenous and non-European people, they were victimized and they were oppressed, but they could also be powerful, and that the history of West Africa and the history of, you know, indigenous America and the history of India is one of power and resilience in the face of kind of British violence and colonialism. So what my book does, it flips the story on its head, and it looks at the 300 years of British expansion from the perspective of these indigenous and non-European people. And so, you know, like the Jamestown colony, the first British colony in North America, which is seen as this kind of unmitigated success, but actually it took 50 years to defeat the Powhatan people. You know, the story of, you know, John Smith and Pocahontas is what's been romanticized, but actually it's a very brutal war for control of Virginia, and one that didn't always go England's way. And so it kind of rebalances that story. And it's a history of, and how it can inform the future, I think, is that it can, you know, help, I think, people, especially that, you know, live in countries that have been shaped by the legacy of the British Empire and colonialism, is they can look back to a history that isn't just one of victimhood, but actually inspiring, empowering stories of resistance down the generation, sometimes intergenerational resistance, all the way through to independence in the 20th century. And so I hope it's an empowering history, one in which Indigenous and non-European people could be victorious against British oppression and colonialism. And whilst, you know, and ultimately many of these countries were ultimately defeated and colonized, sometimes that still took 100 years. And there were heroes in these stories that died to defend their country and their way of life. And so hopefully that, you know, these are new kind of histories we don't tend to get taught here in school, or you don't tend to get from you know, popular history books on the bookshelves. And I hope that that's a corrective, and that it could be read and consumed as a new kind of history of countries that were colonized, but still have these long and histories of being successful societies and powerful cultures.
Give us one that we may not know.
So one of my favorite ones is the Caribbean. So we look at the Caribbean.
Entire Caribbean? Are we talking Barbados, Jamaica? What are we talking?
So the Eastern Caribbean, the Lesser Antilles, so Barbados, you know, Nevis, St. Kitts, and Dominica, and those kinds of countries that we kind of the history of those, it's the history of the French and the British struggling for control of the sugar plantations. These were really wealthy islands because of the spread of sugar and the trafficking of millions of enslaved people from West Africa. And that in a lot of our understanding is that then launched the European empires to great power status. And they took that wealth from sugar and slaves and used it to dominate the rest of the world. And erased from that story entirely are the indigenous people that lived there, the Kalinago people. And the Kalinago people are just, you can hardly find them in any histories of the Caribbean, especially when it comes to Europeans. But actually what I found is a story of a 200-year resistance where the Kalinago people defied English colonialism and settler plantation societies, where they fought back, where they raided English colonies and actually liberated enslaved African people. And they threw their doors open to Maroons, runaway slaves, and absorbed them into their societies. And so it's a story of this kind of this absolute breathtaking resistance. And they resist the English, and the English are eventually so worn down by the power of the Kalinago that they have to actually partition the Caribbean between England and France on the one hand and the Kalinago on the other. And so despite the fact that half of the Caribbean is in Kalinago hands, we still just refer to its history in the pre-modern period as European. But it's not until the end of the 18th century, almost 200 years later, where the Kalinago are finally defeated and conquered. And the British take the 5,000 survivors of a once thriving and populous nation, and they deport them to an island off the coast of Honduras. So it's a kind of tragic story in the end, but there's also an inspiring 200-year period of defiance and resistance by the Kalinago people. And so my book The Great Defiance looks at their culture and their society and you know, the impact that they had. They kind of essentially bring the English and French expansion to a complete halt, and they force the English and French to treat the Kalinago as equals, and they have to agree a treaty. Now what we don't ever really see in the history of the British Empire are the British treating indigenous people as equals, but they're forced to because the Kalinago are so successful. And there are these marvelous little anecdotes in these histories of one English colonist who comes to settle on the island of, the Kalinago call it La Amiga, but we would call it St. Kitts or St. Christopher in the Eastern Caribbean. And he's got a wife and kids at home in England, but he establishes a relationship with the Kalinago woman and has a half Kalinago, half English son called Thomas. And when he dies, his wife and kids come over from England, and the wife actually enslaves the half Kalinago son and forces him to work on the plantation, and he escapes. He flees to Dominica, which was then known as Waita Kabuli, the island of Dominica, and he raids the English island, and he attacks the old plantation and liberates the slaves. Ultimately, he's killed by his half English brother, who manages to ambush him and slaughter him and his half Kalinago family. So again, it's a tragic history, but it's also a story of, you know, great perseverance and survival, right in the kind of, you know, kind of heart of horrid, you know, plantation, the horrors of plantation colonialism in the Caribbean. So that for me was just a really good example of, we can't dismiss indigenous people as just inevitable passive victims of English success.
We never talk about the Maroons of Jamaica, who also, we never talk about the Maroons of Barbados, like you just mentioned, in the Kalinago, Kalinago. David Bevere's is here. You're raising children in this world. You identify yourself as, you said you're a white man.
Yes,
I feel like that designation alone feeds a narrative that we need to examine, because whiteness was constructed and created by and large by the Brits, the Portuguese, the French. Y'all got in a room somewhere and made a determination as you were demonizing these people around the world so that you can have power. You created whiteness. And now everyone wants to be it. How do we dismantle that if we can't even do it in our own homes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really such an important question. I think that comes from, you know, education. You know, for a lot of people, whiteness is not a construct. It's it's an ethnicity, it's a race. But exactly as you said,
but if it is, then what is it? So if whiteness is an ethnicity, a race, or a culture, define it.
No, I mean, I don't think you can. It's a construct. It's something that was created to reinforce racial hierarchies to allow Europeans to dominate and become. So I think that the moment we educate and we acknowledge that whiteness is something that is projected onto people, that is reinforced through systems of power and inequality, I think that then we can start to dismantle it and we can understand. That's kind of the thing that I do try and do with the book. And I acknowledge, in the introduction, as a white man telling a history of, indigenous and non-European people, it's not my job to speak for those people. What I can do is switch the perspective and away from the British kind of perspective of, success and superiority. And then once you do that, once immediately you become more inclusive of the histories of people from around the world, as not just being a history of the British Empire in those countries, but if you accept those cultures and societies on their own terms as successful, as resilient, and then you can start to understand the way that whiteness was, almost a colonial or imperial project, and really that's so closely bound up with slavery and the trade in enslaved people as a way to obviously. Is to demonize, to discard the agency of the people that they're enslaving, to dehumanize them, and only through that. And a really good example is, recently there was in the newspaper over here, The Guardian, which is quite a liberal newspaper in the UK. There's an article about the way in which Irish people were sent to America as slaves, and it was kind of a, oh, we all talk about the enslavement of Africans, but the white people could be victims too. Which it was it is that's a trope that's often rolled out by white people to promote this idea of kind of victimhood, to and the whole point is in bad faith. It's trying to deflect attention away from the way in which race was a central component in European history, the way that it dominated other people. And so I did an article for the paper that said that, well, actually no, that they were never enslaved. White people could be indentured, so they could become servants and labor, and the conditions weren't always nice, but the main difference is that they had rights, and in various legal codes they were defined as servants. They had a period of indenture after which they were set free, and they often lived and then owned their own plantations, whereas enslaved Africans were what we call a European term of slavery, which is chattel slavery. So they were rendered as property without rights, and that their enslavement was hereditary, intergenerational, so their children and their children's children would be owned as property. And that is such a vast kind of gap between what victimhood for white people in history could be. It could be bad, it could be brutal, but it was never quite like the industrial scale of the enslaved Africans who were rendered as property, no longer human, but property to be traded, to be bought and sold. And I think that one of the ways that we did that in Europe, because it took some time to actually do, is to render them, to dehumanize them, to render them as something uncivilized. And that's why whiteness was so important, even for Irish people that could be second class citizens in places like Barbados during the 17th and 18th century, but they were never enslaved, they were never dehumanized. And even so, for those
Dr.
people in the
Vivius,
kind of
can you see
lowest,
me? Can you see me?
I can't.
Oh, you cannot. Okay, because I'm like, we got to go to a break. Talking with David Vivius, his new book, The Great Defiance: How the World Took On the British Empire. We're having a conversation off mic, on mic. Talked a little bit about Meghan and Harry. And I think what's fascinating to me is that your media is, it's like Fox everywhere. Like, there's no escape. Like, there's no MSNBC. There's no place to go there. No. So how does a book like yours penetrate the psyche when your entire nation, I mean, hell, you have a prime minister that's Indian, but he was the first boy, like he's more British than, you know what I'm saying? Like, your whole folk were dominated, but you coming in toting to say, this is scary. It's a very scary thing that's happening.
It is interesting because, one of the things that they point to is that we've got, in terms of the diversity of the current government, it is impressive and it's never been that diverse before. But, a lot of, the Home Secretary and the Prime Minister, but, they are completely and utterly regurgitating these long narratives of, that reinforce the kind of what we were talking about earlier, the kind of whiteness, it makes sense when you look at the upbringing. It's all kind of, Eton and Oxford and Cambridge, so there's a certain social and class element to it. But these are both, both the Home Secretary, sort of Braverman, and the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, they are their parents are immigrants, and there's big success stories, and yet the demonization of, like, for example, immigrants has never been, you know, the rhetoric around it has never been so extreme and so inhumane. And it's incredible to think that it's coming from people whose parents, you know, had to come here from Uganda, for example, or from India. And so it's pretty shocking. But it just shows the way in which that these kind of right wing talking points and discourse has been able to seep into mainstream.
But it's human, though. It's human, David, because if you think about it, I made it. I'm not like them. I'm a special magical Indian, special magical Ugandan, Negro, African. I'm a special, I have elevated, because if the whiteness is the goal, I have now graduated into whiteness. I'm never going back, which means I too now will demonize those people, because that's how that happens. So if I have some melanin, I'm going to be even whiter. I'm going to be more harsh than any white person could be, because I have made it, and I have to show them that I'm one of them.
Yeah, it's that pulling of the, you know, putting up the ladder after they've ascended, but you know, for me as a historian of the British Empire and colonialism, our cornerstone immigration policy right now is to deport immigrants to Rwanda. That's the current plan that's been approved in Parliament recently. And the argument is that they're coming here illegally. Well, there is no such thing as an illegal immigrant. Everyone under the Human Rights Act has the ability to seek asylum in a country. And so these people aren't illegal. But what we've also done is prevented any safe routes for people for crossing into the UK. So we've taken away the safe routes. We've deemed them as illegal. And so we are trying to fly them out to Rwanda and resettle them in Rwanda, which has a terrible human rights record, this is being challenged in the course. But it just shows you this, that where we're at is completely, you know, mad. It's bonkers, but it does reinforce those pre-existing systems that are legacies of empire that, you know, you could argue that have kind of come home to roost in our country after the collapse of the empire. And it's just, you know, and things like Brexit, you know, withdrawing from the European Union, the whole idea was to then immigration would stop. Well, we live in a global world. You know, borders are malleable. Unless you're going to try and build a big wall, then you're going to have people crossing between borders.
Well, we this had a president that tried to do that.
Exactly. And so for me, you know, and our whole idea was that we're going to come out of the European Union and we're going to be a global country. But actually what we're doing is we're putting up walls, and we're becoming more insular, and we're becoming very small-minded. And I think that in itself is a legacy of empire. That Greater Britain, that kind of global power has collapsed, and we've turned in on ourselves, and we're rejecting everything that, you know, if you can look at history and divide it into good and bad, which I don't think you can anyway. You know, so some of the greater parts of British history has been that diversity and the way in which a lot of our cities and places like the Midlands and the North have become so diverse and such a cultural melting pot. That's not to whitewash it. You know, there's obviously tension and we've got massive institutional racism in this country, but there are some success stories and immigration is one of them. And to turn on that, it's for me, I just don't understand it. I one of the biggest economic creators in this country is education, and people come here to study our universities and it creates a massive amount of income, but we're currently preventing overseas students from bringing their families with them. And that will in itself discourage people from coming to study in our world famous universities. And so, and that's based, I think, largely on race and xenophobia. And we're allowing that in the driving seat. That's driving our political and social discourse and policies. And it's just I guess it's just deserves in a way for this country to kind of collapse into obscurity.
I mean, you take the children, which is the United States, are going right with you, mommy. David Revere's, and maybe that should happen too. I was saying Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall. Good. Okay. Let's rebuild something. Let's make some scrambled eggs. Hard, of course. Nothing runny, because that's how I like my eggs. Historian of the British Empire. The Great Defiance is the new book, David Revere's. Are you hopeful? Are you hopeful? And who's reading your book? Are they, if there's such an insulation going on in Great Britain, is this cracking through? Like, are you being featured in Great Britain for this book?
It's early days. It only came out last week, so it's kind of brand new on the shelves. But I mean, yeah, it's getting a good response. It's also getting a backlash, and it's upsetting all the right people, I think. And so I think when a book comes out and, you know, people nod and think it's nice, I don't think it's really done a good enough job. And so the kinds of people I thought it would upset seem to be upset by it, which I think is excellent. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I went to see it in a bookshop, you know, as you do, book comes out, you want to go see it in a bookshop. And it stands there and all these surrounded by all these histories of the British Empire and the triumphant narrative of the way that we made the world. And it's the only book on the shelf that you would find the name of a non-European or indigenous person on. And so for a lot of people, that's, you know, that's kind of like erasing kind of traditional British history. But actually, no, it's creating a more vivid, a more kind of inclusive picture. It's adding stories to our understanding of the British Empire. It's not erasing them. And so that idea of flipping this perspective, it's going to create a narrative that is not all glossy and shiny. And I think that the thing about history and why it's so contested and why it is in the States, I know at the moment, in places like Florida, is that you have the ability, when you challenge people's history, you challenge their identity and their culture. And I think when you've got a certain identity and culture that's perpetually been on top and has been able to dominate, and when that comes challenged through things like history, then you're challenging, you know, the powers that be, and you're challenging their understanding of their place in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, what we're seeing now in culture wars, and a lot of people saying, well, we've imported culture wars into the UK from the States, but I don't think that's quite true. Although we you know, there are talking points that we've taken, you know, the appropriation of the word.
You're the progenitors. Yes. of this. You know, Hitler, that they say, you know, borrowed from the Jim Crow laws, but it was actually Great Britain was complicit as well. Like, all of Europe and the United States were okay with the final solution until Hitler was like, oh, let me get France, run me in. Oh, what? Let me get England next. Oh, this is getting good to me. Like, he got greedy. Had he just stayed and even hit Poland, maybe even Russia, he could have gotten rid of all of the black, brown, Jewish people. They were, Europe was okay with that. Europe was okay, and so was the United States.
Europe has a long history of anti-Semitism, and throughout history, that we had periodically kind of expelled our Jewish populations, and Spain famously probably the most millions of Muslims and Jewish people. And so anti-Semitism wasn't new to, you know, to Germany or to Europe in the 20th century. I think the extremity, of course, of Germany in the 30s and 40s was new, but and this is the thing about
he just said history. The inside stuff outside. This is my point. As long as we can demonize one person in history, it lets everyone else off the hook. When America was not just complicit, eugenics started at Harvard. That whole notion of an Aryan master race started in the United States and Boston. The Nuremberg laws, fashioned after the Jim Crow laws, and Britain and all the other European nations were complicit. Hitler becomes the poster boy for all that's bad, but everybody else threw the rock and hid their hands. We should have that conversation, an honest one, globally, and really start to talk about as we have these Nuremberg trials and still finding Nazi guards. Some of these folk in Britain, just like Wells Fargo did with the banks, like we need to start calling a thing and stop gaslighting the world about history. It's not just Hitler. Hitler was a symptom of a net global ill that still is pervasive.
Of course. And we're seeing, you know, the ideas of fascism and Nazism kind of resurge in a really kind of public and mainstream way. But you know, that's a good, you know, it's a good comparison to make, because, you know, for example, the history of the British Empire, it was in a way, a lot of what it did in people's minds was redeemed by the Second World War. It's like, okay, we've done this horrible stuff, we killed millions of people, but hey, we stopped Hitler and we saved Europe, and suddenly, and so you can have a figure like Winston Churchill, who, yes, you can credit him with helping defeat Nazi Germany, but you also have to recognize the fact that he was doing it to maintain British dominance over the empire, that he, you know, regularly advocated the use of chemical weapons against non-European people, places like Iraq and India as well, and that you know, he worked hard to prevent Indian independence for a long time. And so those two things, they don't cancel each other out, they can both be true. But I think to dismiss them because the idea of Churchill's being sacrosanct and Britain's role in the war, is that is, you know, that's no longer history, that's just propaganda, that's distortion and whitewashing. And so I think that these are the kinds of things that in our country we're just not ready to tackle, and I think that, and when people do, they are, you know, they're you know, completely lambasted, and they're attacked and they're, mm-hmm. and they're harassed. And there was a conference 2 years ago at Cambridge where a small number of academics tried to debate Churchill's reputation, and a strong argument that, you know, Churchill was a racist. And the press absolutely had a field day with these academics, and some of them were completely harassed. You know, fortunately, a couple of them actually met Force, the Daily Mail, which is, you know, one of our kind of biggest right-wing newspapers, to actually apologise because they had misrepresented what was happening. But anyway, this is the kind of range of the forces which are ranged against academics, especially who try and challenge some of these cherished national narratives of, you know, the good or the benevolent role that, you know, the empire or imperialism and you know, white supremacy has played.
Before I let you go, Uganda, I'm going to talk about Uganda after you leave. Do you know the history of Great Britain in Uganda?
I know some of it, yeah, but it's not, I'm not a special.
Okay, that's not your, special. Okay, all right. Because I was just curious, they're doing some interesting things, and then I was like, how did Idi Amin happen? But that's another story for another day. As I was thinking about your book, I'm like, you know, Great Britain gave birth to Chucky and then had to kill her. But you didn't take the spirit, though. It's like, you know, you moved the body, you moved the house, but they kept the spirit, the body underneath the house. It's still raging.
And that's a really good example of, you know, the other narrative that we cling on to redeem the British Empire, is that it eventually gave people independence. It gave people independence. But first of all, that independence was often bloodily, you know, pulled from Britain, and in places like Kenya and Malaysia. The other one is that Britain didn't kind of withdraw. Britain, you know, left behind regimes that were very friendly to its interests, that was able to create almost an empire 2.0, the British Commonwealth, where it still had massive economic influences. So it had a role in perpetuating some of these kind of governments that emerged after independence, which were in a way mirrors of the British Empire. But yeah, so it's it is, the decolonization is not such a sanitized, benevolent narrative. That's also one that people resisted and threw off British rule. But yeah,
let me take one call. We're talking with David Vivers, his Vivers, like Justin Bieber's, but with a V. For victory. Let's take Carolyn. Carolyn in Detroit. She wants to add to the conversation. Welcome Hello. To the Karen Hunter Show.
Hi.
Hi.
I was calling concerning Nikki Haley, and I thought about her father when he first came to America. It was the struggles that our ancestors had that allowed him to come to this country, and he got a job in South Carolina at a black college. And my thing is, Nikki Haley, I don't understand her. I can't understand why she can't understand. I mean, it was a black college that paid for her schooling and mm-hmm. everything. I just don't get it. I don't understand.
Well, you know, whiteness is a hell of a drug. So she got grafted in or invited in, and she's never turning back because, oh my goodness, what a life, what a wonderful life to live being white.
But it's like, you know, a lot of these kind of once upon a time slightly, well, not sensible or reasonable, but slightly more moderate voices have jumped on what is turning into a really beneficial grift for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. There's opportunities there for them.
Yes.
And I think that kind of completely crosses in many ways kind of racial and social lines. But, you know, we found out last week that our Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, his grandfather trained insurgents in Kenya in the Mau Mau Rebellion against the British Empire. And it's hardly been reported anywhere. It's hardly been reported. And you think, what does his grandfather think of him now as being the poster boy of this establishment, one that's entrenched in racial lines?
Delusion that you have to live in. But I often say delusion's powerful as well, because delusional people tell themselves that they're greater than they are, and then it becomes a manifestation. Like, well, the rest of us are like, I'm not good enough. Nah, I'm the greatest. And then it manifests, even if you're not. It's not like they're Muhammad Ali. We're talking about purely mediocre people of moderate intelligence. Said, I'm going to dominate, and spoke it into creation. There's something to be said for that. And it's a marvel. But also, I feel like there's a blueprint for how to do it in the opposite, meaning to serve everybody and not just serve the power. But let's reverse engineer. I'm always loving having conversations like this. So I want to thank you for coming in, giving us your time this late at night over there across the pond. And, you know, you can come on back anytime, Dr. David Beavers. Beavers.
Like Beaver, but with a B.
Beavers. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. I've had a great time. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Same. The Great Defiance is the book, How the World Took on the British Empire, out now.
Hey, this is Karen Hunter. You can listen to The Karen Hunter Show live every Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. East on SiriusXM Urban View Channel 126 or anytime on the SiriusXM app.